Sean Hughes.
Off the radar.
You're listening to Off the Radar with Sean Hughes. A very special guest today, Keith Farnham.
Farnan.
Yeah, I see
Farnan,
it.
Say it.
Exactly.
Did you do that on purpose? Because I said to you, I don't really care how you say it.
Well, that and, like, Keith's way of saying how to remember his name is to think of a distant granny. And is that how you
Farnan.
Explain
it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Farnan.
So I like that because I was so cool about it. I was like, oh, I don't care how you say my second name. And as soon as you
got
it
wrong, you're livid.
The old family heritage came out of me. And I was just like...
Bottom line is, I don't think anyone, like, it's a lovely way of, and it works the way you describe how to say your name, but no one in real life has ever said Farnan in a sentence, I don't think, ever.
Farnan. Yeah. Do we have a Farnan? Well, the problem is that there's a Farnham in Surrey, so I have to do something.
Oh, no, I appreciate that, but I'm just saying, you're never going, the end of a sentence kind of going, are you that Farnan?
That's there you go. You say it, or let's go to the Indian. Oh, but that's too far. But they got Nan. Oh yeah, it's good.
You got the got
far Nan. Yeah, the far.
And even if it's the end of a sentence where you're going, are you that far Nan? You'd say it like that, so you wouldn't say far Nan.
But that would be better for me than Farnham. I'd rather people go far Nan. I should do that in future. Keith Farnan.
But that would drive you crazy after a couple of months.
You know what? People trying to explain my name to people has driven me crazy for years. And so, like, because it's Keith as well, so it's a soft TH. It's like Keith. Yeah. It's not like it's John Farnan. It's Keith, which gets lost. It's like the, and then it's Farnan. And by the time you get to people have lost interest in my name. So they say whatever the hell they want at the end of it. They're like, Farnan.
Well, you're going to be with me for a couple of shows, so we'll chat away. But now a special guest, Rosie Farnan.
Yes, I'm your sister.
If Rosie Willoughby.
Yeah, Rosie Willoughby. And you did say my name right. A lot of people go Willoughby. They like to add that extra little flourish and assume that I must be related to Holly Willoughby, who I bear no resemblance to whatsoever.
It's a lovely name. It's an elegant name.
Oh, it sounds
like a
sort of Jane Austen character, isn't
it? But
who
thinks it's Willoughby?
Well, lots of compares do. They always like to do it wrong, even if they've just asked you just before and say, what's your name again? Well, you say Willoughby, and then they get it wrong.
My level of, like, I don't think it's a challenge, but and I blame dyslexia. I say I'm dyslexic. It's like when I'm that age where at school they don't ever check you for stuff like that. So I just assumed I'm not thick, but I can't spell, so I must be dyslexic. Because I remember as a kid they asked me to smell grass, and I spelled green. So that's... obviously word blindness. Yeah. And I'm not like,
but your word association was good there.
Yeah.
But I think everyone has, there's a, like, no brain is perfect. Every brain has something.
I appreciate that, Keith.
You know what I mean? Like, every brain has a little.
Comedians.
Yeah, I know, especially. But because I had such a, and I still have a problem with the word photographer. Like, and I have to stop myself because I'm about to say photographer. I'm about to say photographer and I have to stop and go, photographer. Let it
flow. Who's to say? Who decides where the emphasis goes?
Well, Sean does.
Yeah.
Sean the grammar Nazi.
Before we go on to the point I'm trying to make is, but Irish people, I don't think Irish people can say murder. It doesn't sound like it's a serious thing that's happened. There's been a murder.
That was murder.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But then you use it as a word for just, oh, that was terrible.
Yeah.
That's true, we do. Like, deadly. Like, that's deadly. Like, you know, it's a really good thing.
And say F-I-L-M?
Film.
Yeah, we put a U in there. Why do we do that?
And I was really trying not to put a U in there. I was really like, don't do the U thing. Put the film there.
I don't understand why we do that.
Well, it's probably, it's got to be something to do with learning Irish when we're kids. Like, it's got to come to, because I think, like, you look at Beckett, you look at a lot of the way playwrights.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah. Let's bring out, oh my God, let's bring out the wanky hat. But
what
you
does
look,
that look like?
It's very messy. But I think that we're really good at sort of, we just have different ways of saying things in English because I think of the way we're taught Irish in school.
Right.
You know, I think when you're taught Irish in school, there's little things like when you say feckum. You know, it's to see, but, you know, and then you say film. It's not that big a difference.
Yeah, but no, but like all Irish people say film, even regardless if they were good at Irish or even studied Irish or anything. So there's definitely something culturally there.
Yeah, there is.
Do you think it's because when we were excited to see a film when we were a kid, we give another little emphasis to it?
Film!
Maybe that's why people say Willoughby to introduce me, because they want to add that extra syllable, like film. Willoughby, because they're so excited that I'm about to come on stage.
That's not, I think that's valid. No, that's valid.
I'm going to claim that. Nice. I'm going to have
yeah,
that.
It's like...
But accents, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because my accent has become this weird sort of
so where are you
slightly
from, Rosie?
Posh southern hybrid. But I was actually born in Liverpool and I've totally lost my Scouse accent.
Even when you're doing an impression of it, you've lost it.
That's, I know.
That was the worst Scouse impression.
It's not that bad.
So when,
it's coming back now. Yeah.
It's coming back now.
So when did you leave Liverpool?
I was born in Liverpool, in Crosby, and I grew up in a place called Ormskirk, which is not that far from Liverpool. It's a really tedious, boring place. I hope they're not all listening. But I always say to people who don't know, it's a bit like Liverpool if you take away everything.
Right.
And it's just a kind of market town famous for its gingerbread and, you know, not much else. And so my parents didn't have... my dad's got quite a sort of Lancashire accent. He talks a bit like that, you know.
I love him already.
And he's quite an eccentric character, actually. But my
I don't care what he's like. I've forgiven him everything.
My mum sort of had more of a hybrid accent because she travelled around a lot because her dad was a Methodist minister, so she'd had quite an interesting childhood.
So you were brought up in an Arthur Miller play.
I don't know what it was, but it was very weird. I was an only child. I was very lonely and isolated and just went off into my own fantasy world, really. And I used to write songs. I was a singer-songwriter for years, and comedy is just something that organically happened because I used to chat between the songs.
So you are Billy Connolly.
Can I ask you?
Kind of, less hairy.
I was going to ask you about your granddad, the Methodist minister. Was he around when you were, do you remember him when you were a kid?
Well, when I was only really little, he died when I was sort of quite young.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Keith.
I really feel bad now because you obviously skipped over that bit. But I was just fascinated.
I read the biog.
Did you not see my black armband?
Oh, wow. The tears.
It's the anniversary. Rosie's only here because she was in next door at grief therapy.
There's something funny I want to try and say, but I know it'll just come out so badly, so I won't say it.
So, it's
no,
okay.
But it's. I was just fascinated about you had, you know, a granddad is a Methodist minister. That's sort of really Southern Gothic, you know, the idea of the sort of the booming sort of presence, you know, because it's funny when you meet comedians and they talk about their family. There's always the sort of the eccentrics and there's the quiet part and there's the town you grew up in. But then there's one relative that just sticks out in your mind.
Oh, yeah,
who was like he would walk in and he would fill the room with personality and usually whiskey or drink or whatever.
Yeah, no,
anyway.
Because Methodists don't drink, of course.
But it's the religion, it's the preaching. It's
under
the
wraps.
Yeah, but is it Methodists don't drink the same way that priests don't have sex?
Well, I mean, neither of my parents drank very much, actually. But that meant whenever they did, occasionally, they were absolutely hammered. We once were on a holiday where we'd been given a packed lunch by this hotel, and they'd given my mum and dad each little, you know, those very small bottles of
miniatures.
Wine. It's tiny. It's practically a miniature. It's not quite as small as a
You mean the little half bottles
the
that
little
they give
half
you?
Bottle, yeah.
M&S.
And they both had one of those, and they were practically falling off the side of the mountain. They were.
It's always confusing when you're drinking with a priest and they ask you for a 12-year-old and you have to ask them to make sure it's the malt they want. Oh, dear.
Right. But it was terrible on those holidays, actually, because my mum, I tell people about this and they don't believe me. My mum used to make us wear...
What did your mum and dad do, though?
They were both teachers. They were both lecturers. But my mum used to make us wear these paper pants on holiday.
Yeah.
But I tell people about this and they're like, what? Because my mum, we'd often go on self-catering holidays and she didn't want to do washing. And there are these weird pants that I think women in hospital wear when they're going to have a baby. And they're just kind of paper ones that you throw away. But they were very weird because they would like rip and you'd have.
But you just wore them at mealtime.
No, we wore them on holidays when we were going. I got taken on long, boring walks and things.
So, but why were your parents in prison? And you went to visit them?
No. This has gone really weird.
No, so I think, is this recollected memory gone wrong here? You
Probably.
Were wearing weird paper pants as your holiday uniform.
Yeah.
Right.
We weren't in prison. Well, I mean, I was only in prison in a sort of a mental sense in Ormskirk.
There.
We were in we lived in this road called the Serpentine, which was like this cul-de-sac. It was like this loop. But we once reclaimed it one year as a running track, and we had our own Olympics inspired by sort of all the drug cheats and things.
This sounds like amazing as an Irish person. Because I lived on the cul-de-sac. We didn't call it the Serpentine, just called it the cul-de-sac. You know, like.
Was there only one?
Yeah, there were quite literally, and we weren't allowed to jump over that at any
point. Each town was allowed one cul-de-sac, though. I think that was the rule back in the day.
That's probably a good rule.
Otherwise, you were getting above yourself.
But, Roger, the question I did ask was, when did you leave Liverpool? Because there's no hint of the accent.
No, I went to York University, which I have to say was full of quite a lot of sort of the Oxbridge reject types. And I think I wanted to fit in, and I started that we actually found some... we used it in a show of mine. We found some footage of me presenting on York Student Television, which is just amazingly funny, sort of right at the very beginning of the 90s. And I've put on this ridiculously posh accent. I know I sound sort of quite well-spoken and southern now, but I'll give myself away because I'll say grass, not green, I'll say grass. You know, I sort of started saying things like, oh, hello, could I remind you? You know, I started sounding like Joyce Grenfell or something.
But did you do elocution lessons and stuff like that?
No, I think I just taught myself because I always loved accents. And we used to have a Scottish maths teacher, Miss Lauder, who was usually on drugs. And we'd all just run out of the classroom and see if she noticed. And she'd say, take a seat. And we just liked sort of mimicking her accent. And I went to Australia for a bit, travelling around doing gigs there. I love the Ozzo accent as
but
well.
You didn't consciously try to polish... Because I nearly got into a fight recently. You didn't try to consciously polish off the accent, was what I was going to ask. I mean, it just sort of happened slowly but surely.
I think when I was a student and went to university at the age of 18, 19, I was deeply insecure, as many of us comedians are.
You see, I nearly got into a fight in Bristol.
I want to obviously ask for that, but I think everyone's insecure in life, not just comedians.
Particularly at that age.
We can't grab hold of that. Keith, tell me about your fight and talk.
Because I'm from Cork, right? And there was this girl, I was just outside. It wasn't anything to do with the gig or anything. We were just outside a bar, a couple of maids, having a pint. And I heard this girl talk. I said, oh, you know. And I said something about, you know, West Cork. And she started shouting at me.
This is in Bristol?
In Bristol. And she was from Cork as well. But she had a very strong Cork accent. Now, my Cork accent is gone completely. Like, I'm just interested in the whole Liverpool thing. And I never remember trying to get rid of it. Yeah. But it's so hard now when you meet. And this girl was so angry at me because she thought I was... Because I started talking to her because I picked up on her Cork accent. I started talking to her a little bit like this. And it came back a bit. And I, you know, not quite as bad as that. Like, and suddenly, like, it was just a face-off. And I was trying to explain that I was really from Cork, but it got worse and worse. Because I was like, no, I'm really from Cork. And she's like, stop taking the mick out of me. And I'm like, I'm really not. Like, I'm from Cork. But it's a funny thing that I feel like I've been removed from the herd.
Who won the fight?
It was called off. Okay. Rain. No, we had to be. She would have won. She would have smashed me. Probably. Like, have you ever seen an angry Cork woman? There's no way.
Well, my mum's from Cork.
Is she?
Yeah.
Which part?
For Moy. That's what I can do. A Cork accent, no bother at all.
Not that was, for some reason.
I say that and kill myself halfway through it. I feel
not even that it's hard to explain to Irish people about my accent, but especially to Cork people, it's almost like I've betrayed them.
Yeah.
Like by talking like this.
Yeah, but you know, I mean,
and I'm sure Liverpool people feel the same.
Oh well, I'm sorry, Liverpool. I never sounded really, really Scouse.
But also, because you said you were a singer songwriter.
Yes.
So when did you start that then?
I was singing and writing songs in my bedroom from a really early age, and I think when you sing, have you noticed people always go a bit American and do a very different accent? So I think that's
what I was thinking of
as well, because you kind of train your voice to do certain things. So. Yes,
so were you doing gigs and stuff then?
Yeah, I was doing loads of gigs. I sort of supported a lot of people like Bob Geldof and Jamie Cullum. And Midge Ure once made me a cup of tea in his dressing room in St Helens.
That's horrific, isn't it?
It was very sweet. It was very sweet. But I did...
What
I did
was in
some...
the tea? Do you remember waking up the next morning going, oh, God, what happened there, Midge Ure?
No, that was Tony Hadley. No, we did support Tony Hadley.
But was it folk music you were doing?
It was kind of acoustic singer-songwritery stuff. I had a band, but when they all broke up, that's when I started kind of just making fun of myself.
What was the name of the
band? Very self-deprecating. Who was in the band?
What was the name of the band?
Oh, we were just my surname, Wilby. And we weren't, like, famous, but we...
Not the travelling Wilbys, no.
No, not the travelling Wilbys. But we travelled around and we did gigs and I sort of had an ever-evolving lineup of musicians. I always say that they left after I'd slept with them, but I was only true in a couple of cases.
How many was in the band? Don't tell me it was an orchestra, because that'd be awful.
Well, for a while. It actually did grow quite large at one point, the band, not anyway.
Okay.
But for a while, we had sort of cello and sax and percussion and drums.
You did say
sax
there.
Sax, yeah. Yeah,
but so, but what intrigues me is because, Keith, did you listen to lots of music when you were, like, were you passionate about music?
Oh, a particular type of music. Like, my dad gave
not
me.
Not metal, please.
What? What?
Not metal.
What? Oh, yeah. Oh, how did you know? How did you? Like, are you just looking at me with the look? I didn't look like this when I was a kid, obviously, and I didn't look like this when I was a teenager. I was a very clean-cut teenager, but I had, like, Iron Maiden T-shirts that were
really?
Ironed. So it was, like, really funny because I was trying to be hard, but it was like my mother would iron the T-shirts when I wasn't around. Oh, but it was my dad gave me, like, Thin Lizzy, Led Zeppelin, Santana, Black Sabbath, and one of the, you know, but that was
Bananarama.
Bananarama, that's right. Michael Jackson, that was my first one. But that was the sort of music that we were given, because that was what he listened to, and that's what I really got into. And I'm still sort of into.
Everyone, when I was, because I've always been really passionate about music, and everyone, when I was 15, everyone in Firhouse where I lived, everyone loved heavy metal. So I loved heavy metal, and I bought about 6 albums in the course of, like, that month, and then...
What'd you buy?
Gillan, mainly. Deep Purple.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I realised after a month that I really didn't like heavy metal, and it was that weird thing of, it was peer pressure. I couldn't tell the other people that I didn't like. I never got Iron Maiden. That's what everyone loved. Iron Maiden and Metallica.
Yeah, Iron Maiden was down a bit. Guns N' Roses, Metallica, all down. You know, I still, like, it was Thin Lizzy, Led Zeppelin were at the top, sort of, you know. So it was never heavy metal for me. It was more sort of, I suppose, heavy rock.
But the point I'm trying to get is, like, because did you, like, you know, want to be in a band when you were a kid?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, the most humiliating day of my life was I could play a little bit of guitar. And when I say a little bit, I mean like chords. And this band was looking for a singer. And I knew the drummer and he was a nice guy. And I said, why don't you come along, you know, bring the guitar. Maybe we'll uncover a talent. We got into this garage and there's like 4 guys.
That was the Wilbies, yeah?
It was the Wilbies, yeah. Yeah. Apparently I wasn't good enough to get in the band or the sack. No, but I remember like there was the band, but then they had all their girlfriends there who were all the cool girls of the town. Mm. And it was awful. I tried, because I couldn't really play, and then we tried like one thing, like simple, like Hotel California, and I just...
But because of nerves, or you couldn't sing?
It was both. I didn't really have a good voice, but if I had confidence, I could just belt it out.
Yeah.
I had a set of lungs in me, but I didn't have either, and it was awful, and I just shrunk into nothing, and I never played again.
Maybe you should have done heavy metal, because that wouldn't matter so much.
I know, just a few power chords and shouting the word devil, biscuits.
You could have done that.
Did you give up straight away? That was it?
I didn't play in front of anyone for years. I was so humiliated, myself and my brother, because my brother was a brilliant classical guitarist, and we would play... We would learn like Radiohead B-sides. And we would learn like really, really bad Radiohead B-sides, and we'd love them and we'd sing them really, because then nobody knew what they sounded like.
What era Radiohead though?
What era?
Yeah.
Oh, we're like, talking like sort of Pablo Honey, Airbag B-sides.
When they were good.
Well, I still like them now, but
they went kind of crazy. I mean,
did you not like the when they got a bit experimental, Rosie?
I did quite like it, but I suppose because I was a songwriter, I'm a lover of a great song with a great chorus and a structure. And I used to play their there's a song of theirs that I used to play.
Creep?
No, not Creep.
Oh, Thinking About You.
No.
Just hum it, I'll play it. Just come on, it's the moment I've waited for.
Is it a B-side? I'm here for dreams, folks.
High and Dry. High and Dry,
that was gorgeous. That's hard to sing.
Oh, yeah, but it's got lovely chords, lovely chord progression. That's quite a high key, though.
Yeah.
So I used to, that one's lovely. But I remember doing auditions for the band, actually. It was really...
But it was your band, though.
It was my band, but we auditioned people to come and play.
Right.
I auditioned people to come and play with me. And I remember there was one drummer. I really wanted a female drummer because I thought it would be super cool. But there was one girl, she just came along and she played the same rhythm to every song. And she just went, well, don't you have any that go like this? And was just doing one rhythm as if it was like my fault. I had not written songs that fitted her drum pattern that she'd practiced all her life.
Oh,
because I had the exact same thing, Keith, where I tried to be in a band and I
what did you play?
No, I couldn't play anything, but I was going to be the singer, and and my voice is all right, but I just, in front of people, I was mortified. But I found from experience, if you're quite close up to the mic Everyone can sing.
Ian Brown.
Well, he gets
and what happened with the... So did you go for an audition or did you...
I was too mortified to do that. It was like friends, we were going to get a band together and I was going to be a singer. And then I remember we were doing Regatta de Blanc, the place and stuff. But you know, I was just too shy to do it. But
even with your friends in the room.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm fascinated. Both of you said you were too shy to sing.
I know.
But you're totally confident as comedians. What?
Yeah,
how
now we are. Not,
yeah, because now we've all our dreams have been crushed. There's nothing left to live for. Why not, you know?
But no, I just noticed if you get quite... Because even when you do High and Dry there, it sounded okay. Because if you do get... You don't have to really sing when you're recording a song. Now, Rosie, I'm not really...
Well, I mean, I joke about Ian Brown, but he got sort of into trouble, didn't he? Because he had recorded the Stone Roses albums, actually, and sang really, really well, close up to the mic, singing really softly. But then there was a legendary performance at Reading, which got totally slated because he couldn't really sing live because he, you know, I guess he wasn't the type of singer to really project and stay in tune. But there, you know, there is a skill to singing quietly.
Oh, absolutely. But see, the reason I was bringing that whole thing up about and asking Keith if he wanted to be a singer is... I think like, I love doing comedy, and I think it's the best thing to do in the world. Yeah. But we could go out and do the best show in the world, and people go, "That was great." But someone comes on with a guitar, and you can have people in tears, and it's emotional. Mm. And I'm always looking for that emotion in comedy that you get in music that you never get. So how is it for you having done that on stage, and then regardless of how good a comic you are, you're never going to get that same emotion. I feel like I might depress you, but you know, you're never going to quite get that thing.
You've gone on about my dead grandfather.
I'm so glad Sean's done that. I'm so glad because I'm still feeling bad about your dead grandfather, and I did nothing to him. God.
But do you know what I mean?
Did you poison the wine?
Roger, does that make any sense of what I'm saying?
Yes, I do know what you mean. Yes, I loved, I mean, obviously when I was doing music, yes, you could move people and that was a wonderful thing. Whereas in comedy, particularly when you're doing a club set, you're doing your 20 minutes, wherever, touring around, there is a pressure to sort of have a laugh every few seconds or however frequently. But I've done a lot of comedy storytelling shows that I wouldn't necessarily bill as comedy that sometimes I do in Edinburgh and might bill as theatre. You know, like Daniel Kitson is the god of that sort of genre where you can perhaps explore a bit of a depth of emotion. I mean, I've been to Daniel Kitson and cried.
Yeah, but I still think... Even as good as Daniel Kitson is, if you get someone singing a song, it's just that first, he's going to move the crowd more.
I mean, Stuart Lee finished one of his shows singing a song.
Yeah, but not. I'm not talking about a comic singing a song.
No, but not a comedy song. It was just a heartfelt, nice.
Because what I love as well is like you're saying, like this is the exact same as Billy Connolly says. Like you just all of a sudden the in between. Banter and the patter became more and you stopped with the songs and I find it really sad where you do this really emotional song and just go and people are going to go, "Here's one for you." And you just tell them a gag after.
I think almost that was why it really worked. And I'd almost like to do that again, but I don't know. It's such a weird juxtaposition, like you say, that it is too peculiar to bill it as comedy. But I would do a really heartfelt song and then sort of diffuse the atmosphere of, you know, maybe I had done a song about my dead grandfather or
but isn't it funny that you feel you have to diffuse it? Because there's that place that people get brought by music that suddenly... You know, everyone's almost uncomfortable with how emotional they got. Yeah. And you as a performer have to just... And it's the same in stand-up, I think, when you get to a point where you've created an emotion that they're not expecting and people are not uncomfortable, but they're upset. Yeah. They're upset because you've talked about loss or you've talked about love or you've talked about something and suddenly they're upset. And then you feel you just need to let the valve out a bit so they either can laugh or they can cry. And it's actually easier if you make them laugh because they release it and they don't just sit there... waiting for your next song with a sense of dread because they think they're going to lose it.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to diffuse that.
People don't like to cry in public, really.
No, not at all. I don't even think they'd like to, like, not in front of each other even. Like,
I do a whole thing about it in the my dad dying show, and it's just that thing of comedy is so close to crying as well. Like, your body, the way it reacts is odd. But yeah, I can tell when I can get them and turn them on the sixpence very quickly. Because basically, it's the sadness is no matter how clever you are, people just want to connect. And people, this is why, and you can go on about this forever, this is why stand-up comedy will never really work on television because there's not a connection there. And yeah. live comedy is all about connection. Mm. Would you not agree?
No, I do. I like it's funny. I always used to talk about that because the first show I did was about the death penalty, and it was and one of the stories I told because I worked as a student against the death penalty in the States, and one of the stories I told was about this ex inmate who I'd met, who had been freed after 15 years but had lost her husband, and I'd heard the execution tape as part of my work, and it was horrible. Wow. And I was trying to tell that story, and it's in the middle of a show where I've pretty much. You know, it's the trail of a student from Cork going to Atlanta and what he learns on the way. That's the arc. But at this point, I always felt like I would bring them down, and there were so many shows where I couldn't get them back up because I would go down. It would and it's, you know, it's a serious story. It's a heartfelt story. It was upsetting for me because, you know, she was an amazing woman that I got to meet and hang out with, and I knew all this stuff about her husband, and sometimes I couldn't get myself out of it. Mm. So they were sort of stuck down there with me, and you sort of just got to the end of the show. And the audience would stay with you, but it was no longer a stand-up show.
Yeah.
You know, it felt
how
like it wasn't.
How far in was this?
It was, I kept moving it back further and further, because yeah. at the yeah. start it was about half an hour
so
in.
So it was the encore.
Yeah. it was the DVD extra by the end of it.
But maybe you can do that. I mean, Susan Kalman did a show.
Susan worked 500 miles away from me when we were over there. Yeah, doing this exact same thing.
Right, yeah. And because she did a show where she made this incredibly heartfelt speech at the end about gay marriage, which, well, equal same-sex marriage, which, of course, we now have. And she really got emotional and cried at the end of a very funny show of delivering a lot of good stand-up. And I think the audience really went with that. It was a very successful show and got lots of amazing reviews. So I think you can do that if you've backed it up by... you know, preceding it with a lot of funny stand-up.
To change the subject.
Or not.
A tiny bit.
I don't know if it was that funny. Yeah.
Rosie, so you're gay, but have you been out always as a comic, or is it a thing that is not important?
Doing comedy?
No, like being a gay comic, or does that make no difference whatsoever?
Being a gay comic. I've always been open about that when I was a musician and a comedian. I mean, I used to write songs that would address that as well. I never wanted to trip over myself and sort of say... you know, he instead of she, just to sort of lie right. or say they or whatever, because I just always wanted to be who I was. I mean, my mum was adorable, actually, when I came out. She, kind of to the point of being over-enthusiastic and being a bit embarrassing, she started telling me about her and her friend Joan on holiday and how close they'd been, which is a bit awful, and got out the lesbian poetry book, which she once read a lesbian poem at the tea table to me, my dad, and my first ever girlfriend.
Seriously?
We were absolutely mortified.
That sounds great, though.
I mean, it sounds like such the opposite of what you might expect, you know, sort of, I don't know, like, you know, from your parents back. I mean, I don't know when this was.
Yeah,
but,
well, this was, I was sort of coming out right at the tail end of the 80s after we'd had, obviously, the Thatcher era, and it was a very, very homophobic time. And my school friends were all quite homophobic and would sort of say things in RE lessons like, oh, gay people are going to die. And I was sitting there thinking, oh no. So I think because of all that, and it was quite difficult.
Does that kind of hold you back for a couple of years with that attitude prevailing?
Yeah, I found it really difficult. But as soon as I went to university, you know, there was a gay society and things like that. And
But at that point, you knew you were gay, but you hadn't, like...
At school, I was madly in love with a girl in my class, and I desperately wanted to be her best friend, and I sort of usurped her other best friend, and because I knew that was the closest I could do to sort of get close to her. And I actually used to have crushes on a series of girls. I would try and change my crush every so often so I could sort of have
what
control
age were you
of
then?
It. This was when I was about 15, 16.
Because me and Keith, like at 15, Ireland, especially Cork, we weren't even thinking along those lines. Then.
No. No, I wasn't thinking about. I wasn't thinking about along any lines. I feel like.
But
I was,
you were
I
feeling
was,
sexual.
I was. I don't know what I was. Because nobody explains anything. I still haven't had the chat with my parents about sex. So I think they still think
it
there's no grandkids.
It doesn't happen in school either.
No,
It
doesn't happen anywhere.
Explaining it to them, like, probably by now.
There was a couple of neighbours back in Dublin upstairs. This gay couple, and one of them had an amazing idea about how, because we were talking about it one night, and he said the hardest thing ever is when you're a teenager and you want to, that moment when you realise you are gay and you want to come out, and that's where a lot of the effort, like in the sort of gay movement, he thought should be put, that you should go around to schools. And I thought it was a brilliant idea, and I thought to myself, God, it'd be great to go around to schools in Ireland and England and just have, you know, like a I don't know, either a comic or a stand-up, something, talking to the kids about being gay and just completely diffusing, like just getting rid of all of the, like, you know, the fags and the gays, you know, because that's what they still say in school. Like, you're talking about homophobia.
They say, oh that's gay.
So gay.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what
but
I mean?
But you know what? There is a charity that is doing exactly that called Diversity Role Models, and they get lesbian and gay figureheads
to
go in and talk to the people. So but
is that not a little bit too po-faced, though?
Well, we've got to start somewhere.
Yeah. I think it's a good idea just to, because that's the thing. Like when I was a kid, it was the expression in Ireland, well, in Dublin, for gays was benders, which you don't have over here at all. And that was like, shoot up your bender. And that was
you're
it all
queer,
the time.
You bender.
Yeah. Not even queer, just
queer
bender.
Queer has been reclaimed. A lot of people use that as a really cool word now. And and they're happy to use that.
So, but Rosie, we're coming to the end of our time. But tell us more about just that bridge when you stopped doing the music. And then, so you decided comedy was where you're going to go.
It was a bit of a long, protracted process, really, when I was still doing music. But I completely, on a whim, entered So You Think You're Funny, and did really well in my heat and went through to the semi-finals, suddenly realised I didn't know what I was doing and did terribly in the semi-final. But I thought, well, I must have known to some extent what I was doing a bit, and then kind of dabbled in entering another competition the next year, entered the Laughing Horse competition, went through to the semi-finals, and then in 2006 I entered Funny Women and went through to the final at the Comedy Store, and that's when I started getting offered more
just
gigs.
Sounds like boasting now. I just asked about the bridge. Just quite literally the bridge.
And it was a lovely musical reference, the bridge. Let's take it to the river, let's take it to the bridge. It was lovely.
But I was essentially...
She talks about competitions.
Trophies.
Well,
she's got her medals on the table in front of us.
I didn't win. I started to get in the finals and semi-finals, and so I started thinking, oh, well, I better kind of give this a go, really, because it
felt like... And do you enjoy it, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd say how making people cry singing a song is powerful. I think making people laugh is an amazingly...
So you don't miss
a high.
You don't miss the music in any way. You wouldn't if you could swap the careers.
I love still getting my guitar out and singing a song on my own.
Just on your own.
Well, me and my old band reunited and played a reunion gig last year.
So, all right, tell us what was your biggest hit, so to speak. the song that you went, this is the best song we've done.
I had a song called You Amaze Me that was a really sweet ballad that the girl I secretly fancied, who sang backing vocals in the band, it was really awkward. She actually asked me to sing it at her wedding. And I thought, oh, God, it's actually about fancying you. She didn't know.
Nice. So that's a very Notting Hill or Richard Curtis updated.
Could you go, before I sing this, I'd just like to tell you a little backstory.
Well, no, but I did.
I Want to Kiss the Bride. Was that the name of the song? I Want to Kiss the Bride.
Yeah.
That would have been amazing.
That would have been good. No, I reenacted that moment when I did a show looking back at my music career called...
So you've done on stage, that story.
How Not to Make It in Britpop. And I reenacted the moment where I get a couple in the audience to be the married couple, married couple. And I sort of reenacted what I wished I'd done. Yeah.
But also, do you get the opportunity in that show to sing that song then?
Yeah.
So you're playing off that, because you know people go, actually, that's not a bad song. That was happening as well.
Yeah, you see, I've had a handful of downloads after doing that.
Rosie, for the new year then, what's your plans? Have you got any?
Oh, well, just I'll be touring various different of my solo shows. And I'm on the sort of back burner when I get time. I've got ambitions to get a book out and I'm writing, but I don't know when that will actually get finished.
What's the book about?
Well, I have been developing
Is it about Thin Lizzy? No, he won't be reading
it. I have been developing a memoir about my music career, but I've got another book idea that might perhaps sell more.
Is it about Thin Lizzy? Is it Wood?
No.
No, I don't mean that. That's
You're
terrible.
That's off the radar. I'm Sean Hughes. I'll see you very soon. Subscribe, I believe, is what they say.
Sean Hughes.
Off the Radar.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things!